From Deep Inside the Death Star, I'm Chad Beter.
And I'm Andrew Richards.
And we're here in Larry Osterman's office. Welcome to Defrag Tools, the show that takes you inside Windows and inside Microsoft. I did it that time. All right, so we cut it off a little bit short last week because we have this long conversation with Larry about API contracts, and it gets pretty technical.
Pretty awesome.
Doing some great work under the covers to make Windows that much better. So let's go ahead and jump into that now.
Roll the tape.
Roll the tape.
Very cool.
Well, cool. We came here to attack your mind rather than your things.
So, okay, good.
So we know that you've been working on awesome stuff for Windows 10 and particularly within the WinRT space. So mm-hmm. we thought we'd get you to give us a bit of an overview of what you've been doing what it is.
So what I've been working on actually for the past, oh my gosh, almost 7 years now, has been the Windows runtime type system. And that's something people don't actually think about a lot, but it's critical to how you build APIs. And what I've been working over the past couple of years has been really about how do we change them over time? And how do you extend and expand the things, the capabilities of an operating system in a way that developers can take advantage of? And our current buzzwords are natural and familiar. The idea is that you write code that feels natural and normal, the stuff that you would every day, and we make sure that the OS matches whatever your language is. And that's been our job. That's been my job. It's been figuring out a lot of that stuff, working with the languages teams, and I've owned actually the low-level tooling that's used by the Windows developers to create the APIs that are then distributed to our customers. So I don't make the APIs, well, except for one type that I actually own, but I don't make the APIs, but I do build the tools that are used to make the APIs. And so they're shipped with the SDK and stuff like that. And I'm the guy who came up with some of the really weird arcane rules that people were like, why do I have to do this again?
They can blame you.
They can absolutely blame me, and I can guarantee you I can give you a very good reason for every single one of those stupid rules that totally makes sense.
So does this kind of encompass the idea of, you know, the verbs that you get on front of the function names and stuff like that? Does it go down to that level about naming?
No, it doesn't. That's purely about the language projection. So let's talk about Win32, for instance. Yes. So let's go back 20 years, 30 years.
30.
30 years. Yeah, 25 years. Mark Lukowski, Steve Wood, a bunch of other guys built the Win32 API surface. When they built the Win32 API surface, they chose to use the C type system for that. So,
C was the predominant language
at
the time.
And C was the language at the time. It made perfectly good sense.
C++ wasn't really even that.
C++ was really not a thing at the time.
Yeah.
It was just becoming a thing. We didn't actually have a proper C++ compiler. Mm-hmm. So building an operating system around C++ paradigms really what didn't make any sense.
Right.
But building around C absolutely makes sense, and it was completely the right thing to do at the time. So they built a type system, though they appropriated the type system, and they designed a bunch of APIs. And over the course of the next 20 years, we figured out how to version those APIs, how to change them over time. Because your APIs are going to change over time. But you have to rules about how to change them, because the one thing you can't do is break apps.
Right.
You simply cannot break existing apps if you have any choice whatsoever, because when Firefox stops working, when Adobe Photoshop stops working, a lot of people get really, really, really mad.
Right.
And when your line of business app and your corporation stops running, the entire corporation stops, and that's a big, big, big deal. So for us, making sure that we have the flexibility to change things over time.
Well, it's one of Microsoft's crowning achievements that we've kept it so consistent.
And it is. Yeah. It is a huge achievement that we've done this.
Yeah.
But now when we build our systems, when we built the Windows runtime type system, when we built the underlying thing, we said, how are we going to build this thing so that it actually lasts for 20 years? What are the things we need to support? What are the types and constructs we need that we can express to all the languages that we want? So for instance, what this meant was we don't support we don't support operator overloads in the Windows runtime. And the reason we don't support operator overloads is that JavaScript has no native concept of an operator overload. Operators are associated with a type, and there's no way to actually overload them. Mm. Well, sorry, type's the wrong word, but it's a...
So a lot of the thinking actually just has to incorporate languageability and...
Absolutely. And we have to think about how things project, and that's why we talk to all the language partners about this.
I'm assuming you constrain it to a set of languages that are in the same domain. So you're not going to try to... Are you going to try to worry about functional programming and all those other type of approaches to programming?
Well, there is an F-sharp language projection, apparently.
Yeah.
I heard somebody was... Sorry, maybe I'm wrong.
There's F-sharp .NET runtime.
But there's the F-sharp... That gets you.
Yeah.
But maybe that's not a good example. I don't know.
But you are constraining yourself to realistically C, Java-ish style languages.
The ALGOL 68 family of languages, yeah. That's kind of where we're constrained, but... that's not to say that we couldn't consider, for instance, actually, the Islandwood team recently released an open source Objective-C version. Again, kind of an ALGOL 68 language, but really radically different. Mm. And they basically took the metadata that we produce for all the APIs, and they actually extended that out and built a representation of our entire type system in Objective-C in a form that's natural and familiar for Objective-C developers, which actually, whenever I go to talk to those guys, it blows my mind because they're so smart and they did such an amazing job.
That's cool.
So as I said, we think about how do you change things over time, and we know how to do Win32. We don't really know, we kind of sort of know how to do Windows Runtime. We had to figure this out. One of the things we knew we had to do with Windows Runtime is we were going to build a class system. A system that had classes and structs and enums. We had those kind of types. We knew those. Fundamental types. We have most of the types you would expect to have. Floats, doubles, ints, 16-bit, 32-bit, whatever. We have a lot of those types, and that's all well and good. The language projections then take those and express those. Mm-hmm. But here's the thing. Our classes under the covers are actually built with COM interfaces, and COM interfaces are immutable. One of the really hardcore rules about COM is that if you change the shape of an API, of a COM interface, you have to give it a new GUID. It's not the same thing.
Right.
That constrains and defines how we shape our APIs. So when we think about our type system for Windows Runtime, we actually think about things in terms of mutable types and immutable types. So what are the things that can change on a type, and what are the things that cannot change on a type? For instance, an interface cannot change. A struct, it turns out, cannot change. But an enum can change additively. And what that means is that you can take an enum that has a bunch of labels, you know,
foo,
bone, bar, whatever, and you can add baz and bletch and whatever, bongo and ongo, whatever, to the end of it, and not change the fundamental nature of that enum.
And it has to start with the same numeric ordering, of course.
Well,
you can't change the base.
No, you can't change the numeric. Once an enum label has been defined, it's immutable.
Yeah, right.
But you can add new ones.
Right.
And that's fundamentally because under the covers, enums are simply integers.
Mm-hmm.
And because enums are fundamentally just integers, we have a great deal of flexibility in what we actually pass in and out of methods. We don't change the binary representation.
On the same type of field, how about bit mass? Does that kind of follow the same thinking each bit has to be static, but you can add more bits to the end?
Absolutely. And that's why bit masks are represented as enums. Mm. In the Windows Runtime type system, we have two types of enums. We have flags enums and normal enums. A flags enum is actually intended to use as a bit mask.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And when you mark an enum as a flags enum, we actually, under the covers, emit, if you're coding in C++, we actually emit operator overloads to give you operator or functionality and operator and functionality on the enum labels.
That's cool.
So you can actually say foo or bar, and it actually does the right thing if you're in C++.
Yeah.
Thing is about our classes construct is that our classes construct doesn't actually exist. It's a concept. It's an abstract only construct. So classes are actually kind of cool because with a class, I can actually add new interfaces to that class. And that allows me to do a similar additive versioning. I can add new methods, new overloads, new things to my classes over time. So I can start with the Windows Storage Known Folders class. Started out with just iKnown folders as a base interface. And so the storage known folders class had 5 documents, photos, videos, and
music,
I think.
Yeah. Podcast, whatever it is.
No, podcast was added later, and that's actually part of the interesting story is that podcast was added later. We were able to add podcast later because iKnown folders, the base interface for known folders, that's immutable. That hasn't changed. But we then created iKnown folders 2. And that had a couple of more known folders. Mm. And then in another version, we added a couple more. So over time, we've added more known folders. We've changed and added capabilities to this class. But we've done it in a way that allows us to preserve backward compatibility. Mm. The older apps only ever use the older version of the APIs. The newer versions can use query interface to see whether the new APIs exist. Or if they're universal apps for Windows 10, we actually have APIs that let you know if a particular method exists on a runtime class, if a particular runtime class exists, et cetera. We added APIs that allow you to detect that. And then you can actually write your code to adaptively decide whether you want to call a piece of functionality or you want to just skip over it and do something else.
And this gives you that sort of platform mutability where you can run on phone versus...
Well, that's actually an interesting... Thank you. Because that becomes interesting. Because now let's talk about how we actually do this under the covers.
Okay.
And unfortunately, I'm going to have to go right on the whiteboard. Sorry, guys.
Hey, go on. Stop. Get in there with the camera.
Okay. So hold on, Larry. Okay. So... Okay, well, that's not going to work. That's why there's more than one. So you have a runtime. So we have a runtime class foo. And that was introduced in version 1.0. Runtime class foo has an interface ifoo. So we mark every type with the version in which the type was introduced. In this case, foo has one interface. It's marked as the default interface. The default interface is the interface when I use foo as a parameter to a method, at the binary level, I want to use ifoo. So now, next release comes along.
Is there an equivalent of that in COM?
COM has the keyword default, but it doesn't mean what this means. Mm. We appropriated many concepts from COM, like iKnown and things like that. But we appropriated several constructs, like the default construct. But they don't necessarily mean exactly the same thing as they meant in COM.
Yeah, it's not an IDL syntax.
Yeah. So next release of the operating system, we release ifoo 2. I need to know, when was ifoo 2 added? We add an interface we say it was added in v2, and that's the way the syntax works. Hmm. So let's talk about phone. So we finished Windows 8, and we were like, wow, we figured out how to do versioning. We know how to make it all work, and it's great, and this is so awesome. And then phone came along, and we said, oh, wait. The thing about phone is that phone, of course, is different from desktop. It's missing some types. That's actually not a problem. It also, they wanted to take types in ways that aren't necessarily the same as what we had in desktop. So they're known folders, for instance, actually be a perfect example of this. Known folders started out with the 4 basic things, but now phone 8 came along and the phone guy said, but wait, we want to add podcasts. But the desktop guys weren't ready to add that. So we said, oh, we're going to add a new form of this. And this, by the way, is purely internal stuff. This is actually intentionally hidden from external developers because they don't need to think about it, and we don't want them to have to worry about it. And again, I also need to caveat, this is all Windows 8. This is not Windows 10 yet, because this is where we started, and this is where we started going wrong. And I'm very clear, we started going wrong on this one. We said, fine, what we're going to do is we're going to say, okay, for phone, we're going to add a new version attribute. We're going to mark that this type was added to phone in version 1.1 of phone. And then, oh, phone needed to add an iFoo 3. Because they wanted to add some new things.
This starts to get complicated.
You got it. Sorry, that's not readable, but yeah. Anyway, yeah, it gets complicated. And it turns out when we actually started building the SDK and looking at what we would do to build adaptive apps, all of a sudden we realized, wait, to support desktop and phone, it turns out we need four different sets of metadata. The desktop metadata, the phone metadata, what we call the union metadata, which is all of the types for both phone and desktop, and the intersection, which is the common set that's available for both. All of a sudden, this problem gets really complicated really fast. And then we shipped 8.1 and we were like, this isn't really working very well. And then we got Windows 10. And Windows 10 was all about unification of the entire API surface. Mm-hmm. More importantly, we didn't just have desktop and phone.
Yeah.
Now we had Surface Hub. We had HoloLens. We had Xbox. We had the IoT family of APIs. We had this, we had that. All of a sudden, we were looking at being able to build APIs for, and different API surfaces for 10, 20 different types of Windows. Because as soon as you say Windows is everywhere, the world got really complicated really fast. And this whole bit about separating things out got really complicated, especially, and this was the part that was the absolute worst thing we did. There's no guarantee that desktop will ever adopt interface iFoo 3. Mm. So now the version of Foo is different on phone and desktop. And they're different in ways that are incompatible. So I can now have a situation where I add iFoo 4.
So you're adding FM radio for some reason as a known folder type?
Yeah, something.
Yeah, something weird like that.
I add iFoo 4 to desktop, but phone doesn't pick it up. Mm-hmm. Now I have a class that has two different API surfaces on two different devices, and I, as an external developer, have no way to rationalize that. And I, as a Windows developer, I have to be able to come up with a single binary that runs on phone and desktop that has, because we're building to a common core, but I have APIs that are only going to be available on one or the other. It got really complicated really fast.
Yeah.
And I suppose in the comm world of UFO, doing this, you just end up with a whole lot of unexpected, not interface, not implemented.
Interface errors. Yeah.
Yeah.
You just get a lot of errors, but which is okay, but when you're dealing with the language projections, all of a sudden the apps are throwing when they're on different devices.
Yeah. And
we don't want that experience for our customers. Our developer partners do not want that kind of experience because it's just hard to work around. It makes your testing much harder and everything else. So we realized we were in trouble, and a while back, and Brent Rector stops me on the staircase heading down from the second floor of Building 50 to the lobby. And he says, so Larry, I've got this idea, API contracts. And I looked at him and said, oh? And then as we walked down the steps, we kind of sort of had an idea of what we were talking about. He and I sat in my office for about an hour and a half the next day, which I guess was a Monday, so this was a Friday to a Monday, and we spent for an hour and a half, and we hashed out this new concept of how we version things and how we change this mess that we'd made for ourselves into something that we actually are really pretty happy about and comes out to be pretty cool. And it has a bunch of real nice characteristics that are really, really, really attractive when you're building an operating system that the previous versioning stuff didn't have. And so that makes us really, really happy. And the thing we came up with is this idea of an API contract. And the contract's a horrible word. We've tried to come up with a better one for it, but we can't. The idea behind an API contract is that it's a group of APIs.
So it's kind of like a problem space?
Yeah. Maybe that? It's a set of APIs.
It's sort of, yeah.
What we did was we took the entire Windows Runtime API surface and we divvied it up into a bunch of API contracts. And at the end of the day, we actually ended up with one very large API contract and a bunch of smaller API contracts. That may or may not be what we do in the future, because one of the things we did was we added the ability for, I'm jumping way the heck ahead, you can move a type from one API contract to another API contract. We actually built that into the system because we knew we would get it wrong. But here's the thing about an API contract. A version of Windows, when it implements an API contract, has to implement the entire contents of the API contract. This is actually key. So when I have a contract, which is the I'm going to make this up because it doesn't exist, but it works for this discussion. So we have the known folders contract. That has the three or four known folders APIs. This was my canonical example during the course of development of this feature. But the idea is that there's three or four APIs in the known folders contract. And whenever I implement the known folders contract, it's the same code base that implements it on all the platforms, and it's the same API surface on all platforms. You might actually have a different implementation for various reasons. Some of the contracts do have to have that. But the API surface is identical. Mm-hmm. So I have the exact same APIs. And what this means is that if I know that the known folders contract is present, I know I can safely call the known folders APIs, and I know that their behavior, they will behave in a particular fashion, and thus I can rely on that. And I can rely on that over time. So if I know that the known folders contract exists forever, for the next 20 years, all I have to do is say, gee, does the known folders contract exist? And if it does, I can call all the APIs that are in that contract.
So in a sense, this is, you're modularizing the API
yes.
set, right? You're breaking
yes.
it into sort of logical pieces that are APIs that are related
yes.
in a certain way.
Yes.
Right. So it's one thing for the OS to have the contract. So say known folders is mm-hmm. ubiquitous. But what happens if it's something more like a location where you're dependent on physical hardware?
Location is actually interesting because while we were coming up with this, we had to face the issue of what do we do about things that are not necessarily really universal. Actually, again, the canonical example for that is actually printing. Because you'd kind of like to be able to have printing everywhere. It turns out it's kind of useful to have that. But what does printing mean on phone? What does printing mean on Xbox? So for APIs that involve hardware and devices, we said put them into the universal API contract, put them into the universal bag, but mark them as, but the version, the implementation that lives on a device that doesn't have those sensors simply reports that there's zero GPS sensors, that there's zero printers. And so there's never any printers, so you can never worry about instantiating. And so you can build a very small stub implementation of the API that just simply always returns that there's
Because you always enter it as a collection.
Because you always enter those APIs as a collection, exactly.
So I see this. So the idea of a contract is you're required to implement all these APIs, but they don't necessarily all have to do anything useful.
Correct. Well, okay. If they do something, they have to work completely.
They can't fail. Right.
They can't fail. But they have to produce a result that makes sense,
yes.
And that is meaning that makes sense, and that a developer can detect on. And we have other APIs that are similar to that already. Where, for instance, some of the APIs that interact with hardware devices, return async operations of Booleans, where the Boolean says did it work or not. And this falls into the same category of things. When you open a file, you shouldn't get an exception thrown. If the file doesn't exist, you're going to get back a non-existent file. You get a null result. Same idea here with these is that if the thing doesn't work, give a reasonable result for that. The other really, really cool thing about contracts is that when I'm building, when I'm designing a system, I actually really like very hard, I try very hard to make sure that the system is absolutely foolproof. It's not possible to screw it up. And one of the things we did with the API contracts is we went down that model. So, and this actually, there's a file on the SDK that you can find if you want to look for it. I don't remember the name of it, but for instance, the desktop extension SDK has a desktop desktopplatform.xml file. And within that desktopplatform.xml file, there is depends on UAP. That's the Universal API platform. That's the platform that consists of the contracts in the contracts that are universal. And it has a bunch of other contracts listed with their versions. Now here's the thing. When we build the SDK, we use that desktopplatform.xml to figure out what API contract files go into which SDK, the desktop extension SDK, the UAP, the universal SDK, et cetera. When we build the operating system, we do the exact same thing. The operating system is actually built off of the same platform.xml file. And what this means is that I guarantee that the API surface that is in the UAP XML is on the universal API operating system. When I'm building the desktop operating system, I guarantee that I'm going to be taking every API contract from UAP and adding in these four other contracts. So the OS metadata, the metadata that actually goes in the physical operating system, is tied directly to the metadata that is created from taking all of the API contracts, putting them together to form the OS. And we actually build the OS based, the metadata for the OS. We actually build that based on these API contracts. And that allows us now, again, not screwing up. It sets us up so that we can't actually make a mistake when we're building this, because there's never a situation where something that's in the desktop SDK, desktop will be missing from the SDK. There's never a situation where the SDK will have something that's not present on the desktop, because they're all built from the exact same set of sources. And the exact same set of configuration files are used to build both of these two very different entities.
Right.
That's one of the things I love about the API contract system, is that it gives us this ability to produce wildly different constructs. And we've actually thought about some things that we could do that are even cooler long term. We don't know how to do all of them yet, all of the parts to make it all work, but we have the ability to build a bunch of different things that are not just the stuff that we see here. It allows us it gives us the flexibility to make a lot of changes that we could build in the future for a bunch of different functionality that we might need. That doesn't look at all like what we have today, but we've got the underpinnings. And as I mentioned, one of the other nice things about API contracts is that one contract depends on another contract. So for instance, the known folders contract depends on the storage contract, because known folders return storage items. It returns a storage item.
There's a hierarchy here.
So there's a dependency between this API and the storage APIs.
Yeah.
The storage APIs depend on the foundational APIs. So there are all of these dependencies in here. And the cool thing is, if I decide I need to move Baz out of this contract and into a new contract, then what happens is the old contract simply takes a dependency on the new contract.
So you can introduce granular.
I can take these things and system. Divide them even more.
Yeah,
I can't take Baz and put it back, But I could put it into another contract and move the other types into that other contract if we wanted to do some more dicing and slicing.
And I'm assuming there's no scalability issue here. You can keep on going and going and going.
As far as we can tell right now, there aren't any scalability problems. Again, which is the old system had massive scalability problems because we couldn't scale out. We knew how to version over time, but we really didn't know how to version across.
Well, let's get Win32. Every single function was a contract.
It
got to that point of granularity that it became kind of pointless.
Yeah.
And the interdependency was not really known either.
That's actually been a major challenge of the whole drive to partition Windows into smaller and smaller pieces has been a lack of knowledge of the dependency graph of the internal operating system implementations. What's been fascinating, though, is that over the course of the past 10, 15 years, there's actually been a ton of really amazing work done by the people over in the core team to figure out those dependencies after the fact. And they've actually done a remarkable job of figuring out how to dice and slice and shrink the OS down further and further and further to come down to originally they called it MinWin, but this tiny core of functionality that really couldn't be teased apart. And now we think about things in slightly larger chunks, because it turns out that MinWin chunk was not
too small,
incredibly useful.
Well, it had no console. It had no...
Well, exactly. Yeah, yeah. It was not incredibly useful. Yeah. So we're trying to build things that are a little bit more useful now, which is where we have this concept of one core, which is, again, a minimal OS. And in fact, the one core construct is actually used to build the desktop OS and the phone, the mobile OS, and the Xbox OS in the future, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. All of these things will be built on top of that one common core. And so the reason we were able to build that and create that was because of the analysis work that the kernel guys have done. And it's really quite remarkable, the work they've done. And
I remember seeing some chart back in like the Vista days of all the dependencies between different pieces. And it was like a big spaghetti.
There's a DatViz or something like that file. It covers an entire, I've seen it printed out, it literally covers an entire, 20 or 30 feet of corridor, five foot wide.
And didn't they tried to do a lot of untangling of that,
It was all based on layers, wasn't it?
The architectural layers. The core team has actually been actively working on untangling the spaghetti that we built back in the 90s.
Yeah.
They've been actively working on untangling that spaghetti, and they've actually done a remarkable job of untangling it. I cannot say too strongly the amount of incredible work that these guys have done, because it's just mind-blowing.
It is mind-blowing. Yeah. And I know the simple things like the debugger is required in core because that's a fundamental, right? It's something you have to do. And we had to pull apart layers inside the debugger that you wouldn't even think of.
Yeah.
And it's definitely been a huge undertaking, and our part was just a tiny part of the ecosystem that had to get fixed.
Yeah, I remember they were hearing about things like these very, very low level kind of kernel things that would call these high level APIs that would sort of like go back all the way up again. And
my favorite example of that is actually the message beep API. So the message beep API is an API that's designed
as in ASCII 7 beep beep.
ASCII 7 beep beep. The message beep API is actually an API that's designed to ding the PC speaker. Mm-hmm. It had callouts to the remote desktop service.
Right.
So the message beep API would call into the remote desktop service to see if you were on a remote desktop session. And if you were, then the beep API would be implemented over on the client side,
right.
Not on the server side.
Not the best designed concept, really.
Not the most architecturally sound design.
Right.
But at the time when you're desperately something I've learned over the past 30 years, when you're desperately trying to ship and you just realize that this is a problem that you have to solve, it is unfortunate, but sometimes shortcuts get made. And I think that's true in every engineering organization. And the challenge is in maintaining the discipline to not take shortcuts. That's always the tricky part.
Because then later what happens if you try to take the remote desktop out of the, then it's like, well, now beep doesn't work.
Yeah. Right. So, yeah. Right. And we actually, actually, my team, which somehow ended up owning that API, ended up having to make that fix to untangle those two. And fortunately, we were able to find a way to make it so that it was unnecessary. But
that's part of that work you've been talking about that's been going on for 10, 15 years to untangle that.
Yeah, it's been a long, long-standing run, and we're going to keep on doing it because we're not where we need to be, we're not where we want to be. Probably more want to be at this point, but we're going to find there's going to be pressure to make smaller and smaller and smaller devices. When you want to go down to the operating system on your mouse, there's firmware on this thing.
That's true.
What does it run? Pretty sure it's running some fairly custom thing, but if I want to actually run and do something more sophisticated with a mouse than simply tracking points around a screen.
And then you start saying things like, well, what happens if we make the whole top of the mouse a screen that you touch? Well, then you need a whole device, a display layer, you need a whole rendering layer, you need a whole message
queue
layer.
Yeah, and all of a sudden I now need an operating system, and now where am I going to find the operating system? Yeah. Well,
maybe you could use Windows.
Maybe you could use Windows, and who knows? I don't know.
It strikes me that this sort of API contract thing goes sort of hand in hand with that whole modularization of the of the OS that we've been talking about. That's been happening, sort of progressively getting better and better.
Absolutely.
And this kind of very well fits into that and allows us to not only the operating system becoming more modular, but then the API set as well can match that, right?
No, this is absolutely the case. And again, remember my comment. When I build an operating system platform that support, it has to support the entire API service. Well, if I only want a small portion of an API contract, I'm going to have to tease that API contract into the piece that's there.
Yeah.
We support that. We built that in from the beginning because we knew we were going to have to do it. We made a decision to go with a fairly large surface for the universal API contract because we were worrying about the scale, about how many contracts we would be producing, because every contract we produce has additional overhead, small amount, but some overhead, not at runtime, but at design time. And we didn't want to burden the compilers, and we really didn't know what was the right partition, because all we really had was desktop and IoT and mobile and all of the things that we knew about. And we knew we could define the common set for all of those, for HoloLens, for all those. We knew what that was. And what we settled on was essentially the API surface that's used to write universal apps. Gee, I wonder why that is. Yeah. But that's actually why we call it the Universal API Platform, the Universal API Contract. It's because it's the APIs that are used to build universal apps. Mm. But so at some point, we might come up with something that requires us to split that even further. Yeah. I don't know. We'll find out.
So the actual contracts themselves, are they something that is annotated in the metadata or the manifest of the application, or is it more of a runtime thing decision you make? Or is it a mixture of both? And kind of leading on to that is,
it's part of the type.
How can you explain the difference between maybe a contract and trying to achieve a feature? Like, for example, let's say I want to be a screensaver.
Yep.
That's not really a contract. It's just a style of you visualizing something.
Yes.
But it happens to be invoked in a scenario.
Okay, this is part of this whole point about contracts being a really crappy name. This is where we start getting into it. Because when you start talking about things like screensavers and stuff like that, what you're talking about at that point are types of activation.
Mm.
And the thing that we use for activation is also called a contract. We have a sharing contract, a search contract, an activation contract.
Yeah.
These are also, they use the same word, it's a completely different concept. The API contract really is just about collections of APIs.
So maybe, if anything, that could get renamed to API interface?
No, because interface has also been used.
Yeah.
We really did. We racked our heads for quite some time trying to come up with a better word. Because literally every person in the hierarchy above me hates that word. I don't particularly like it. Everybody above me hates that word. We've racked our brains. We've not been able to come up with a better name. Mm. Unfortunately, our language is not.
It just hasn't got the.
It just doesn't have the. We don't know what the right word is. But anyway.
Yeah.
So the idea here is, so when you build a contract, this is all built in ITL because all of our APIs are actually authored in ITL.
Just use the screensaver example, because I want to use known folders to get to my pictures.
Okay.
But I want to be a screensaver. And let's say that I'm doing it as a universal app, so I can run this on an Xbox and run it on phone and desktop. I don't know if I've just given you an example that is extremely hard, but...
Well, no, it's not. It's yeah. Universal apps work with the Universal API platform, and they have the capabilities in the Universal API platform, and they're done. It's that simple. It's
yeah.
for 95% of the developers out there, this API contract thing is actually not important. The people who actually do care about this, however, are let's say I'm an application that's a voice over IP application. Okay, I have a voice over IP client. And I also want to be able to field calls on a mobile device. Well, the mobile APIs to handle receiving calls are in the windows.applicationmodel.calls namespace, which is a part of the windows.applicationmodel.calls contract, I believe. So what I can do as a developer of this application is I can say, I'm building a universal API app. I'm going to be a VoIP app. I'm going to listen to the network layer. I'm going to build all the audio, whatever streaming APIs I need. And I also want to be able to receive or to monitor calls. I want to know when there's an incoming call so I can do caller ID stuff. I don't know, something. So what I do is I say, if... dot
good job you got two iPods.
Yeah, tell me about it, otherwise I would be in deep trouble. Is API contract present calls contract, and this is not, you'd actually use is type present, but let's say you wanted to know a particular version. At version 2, if that is present, then
do epic stuff.
Yeah. So the idea is that you can now write an adaptive application that does that by looking to see whether the API contract is present or whether the API that you particularly care about is present. There's a lot of different ways you could do this, depending on how deep you want to go. If you wanted to know about a family of APIs, you might want to look for the contract that contains that family of APIs. If you only care about one API in particular, you could just look for that one API in particular. We've tried to design it so that you can look for the things that you might want to look.
So is the UAP contract, is it a family that says I've got these contracts, or is it?
It is an API contract is a collection of APIs.
So it's a contract that has contracts in it.
No, contracts cannot have contracts. They're flat.
Oh, sorry.
That was part of the design. Yeah. We looked at having hierarchies. Platforms can contain other platforms, and platforms can contain contracts. Okay. So when I'm building the desktop platform, I include the Universal API the Universal API platform. The Universal API platform has the Universal API contract. It has the wireless WAN API contract. There's complicated reasons for that. And I think there's one other API contract that is in the Universal API contract, the Universal API platform. The Universal API platform, that is the APIs that are available on every edition of Windows today.
Gotcha.
But this calls contract, that's a mobile only contract. So it's only present on the mobile SKUs of Windows.
Yep.
So if this thing succeeds, you know you're running on a mobile SKU, and you know that you can call any of the APIs that are in this API contract, because contract is a collection of types.
Just thinking about the future and how these in 20 years' time everything goes a bit weird. When you have what you traditionally think is a laptop now, but they've shoved 4G or LTE into it, where
it actually gives more and more laptops now anyway.
You get this hybrid situation where the contract's going to start succeeding in the future.
Mm-hmm.
Is that the idea
behind it? Absolutely. Absolutely, that's exactly the point. Yeah. If at some point somebody builds we actually have a very real world example of this today, Continuum for phones. Mm. Continuum for mobile. You're running on a mobile device, but you're interacting with it on desktop with a keyboard and a screen. But that thing's a mobile device. It's running a mobile SKU of Windows. It can receive calls and send calls.
Yep.
So the APIs that involve call management, your call history, all those APIs are going to be present, even though the user's interacting with keyboard, mouse, and a big old monitor.
Well, traditionally what we call a desktop.
Which is traditionally what we would call a desktop, but it's not. In the future, I honestly believe that as today we sort of have mobile devices and desktop-y devices, computer-y devices, phony devices, but phablets are getting really big.
Yeah.
You know, we're starting to see six-inch phablets at this point. Not too far off to believe that we're going to be seeing 7- and 8-inch phablets.
Yeah.
It's not a stretch.
And there's plenty of tablets down the 8-inch range, and which are popular.
Yeah. One right there.
Right there, right, yeah.
You know, that's a Dell Venue 8 Pro. It's a great little 8-inch tablet.
Yeah.
And we have them all, they're all over the place.
So HP Stream 7.
HP Stream 7, another example of a great little tablet. That line's going to start getting blurred, and somebody's going to want to put call hardware in those little things. So the idea that at some point we decide that, you know what, there's enough things that are using the calls, let's slap it into the universal API platform. Mm. Maybe that happens in the future. Maybe it doesn't. We don't know. And the beautiful thing is I can put the calls contract into it. Maybe we decide that, you know what, actually I'm trying to IoT, no, actually, I can't actually think of an example of a device category where I would never want to put dialing, phone calls.
Xbox, you want dialing Xbox, phone calls? I mean, Skype it already is.
Exactly.
It's just a form of call then.
So I could easily see how that calling, for instance, could become part. Maybe, who knows?
IoT is what's going to run in your Link phone. Exactly.
And that's why I was like, wow, maybe I couldn't come up with a category where that wouldn't make sense. So maybe some point in the future, this becomes part of the universal API.
And you could argue the same thing for location. You could, there's lots of
just about everything.
Yeah.
Just about everything you can think of might end up there, but maybe not. And the beautiful thing about the API contract stuff is, you can actually make decisions based on the needs of the platform. Oh, I want to add in calling. You know, somebody's building up a IoT device. Oh, I want it to make calls. Fine, we'll just add the calls contract to the list of APIs available. Now, you then have to go to do the work to actually make the APIs work on that device. But because everything is built off of the same common operating system core, that work is actually much easier. Mm. Because everybody builds to the operating system core, so you're taking over smaller and smaller pieces to implement the functionality, and the operating system becomes more modular. And this is a reflection of that increasing modularity of the operating system. This is not a cause of. We've been moving there for years, but this is just a reflection of that.
So this is the API view as from an application developer point of view, more of like I'm an app guy. If you come in from the OEM hardware ISV, IHV point of view and more of a device driver person, is it in your ability to increase the contract set of Windows?
No. This is the API surface that is the Windows Runtime API surface, which has well-defined and constrained extensibility points for OEMs and for hardware vendors.
So using the example of calls, we may add it to the OS, but there's no hardware there. They come in, put a device driver there, and the collection now goes from 0 to 1.
Maybe, yes.
That's their influence on the...
Yes. I will be totally honest and say I'm not the person who knows how the OEM extensibility mechanisms work. I know they exist, but I don't know how they work, what the details are.
But the intention from Microsoft is, this is our API set, this is what our contracts, this is what the platform does when we give you Windows for PC, Windows for phone.
Yes.
And we may have stuff that's enumerating as 0 because we see it as a foreseeable extension point. And then it's up to a custom hardware provider to fill the gap.
Yeah, and there's lots of stuff that I do not understand that falls into defining how all that stuff happens. It's just
is limitable.
I live in the world of API and type design. I can give you hours of discussions about type design, type resolution algorithms, names, all sorts of stuff. How one builds or customizes an edition of Windows is simply beyond my scope of things I know how to do.
Yeah. So when you think about where we are now compared to the COM, because I know you did a lot of COM in a decade ago, how far do you think we've come? You think we've gotten to the point where, I mean, COM looked like it was really good when it came out, right?
COM is still really good. I'm a huge fan of COM. There are some things about COM that are really, really, really wonky that make stuff, that can make things more challenging than they are. And in terms of that, we've done huge work because we have abstracted out most of the complications associated with COM so that the vast majority of developers, that even though we are using much of the common underpinnings of COM to do the Windows runtime stuff and to build Windows runtime APIs and applications, even though we're using the common underlying infrastructure, iInspectable, which is derives from iUnknown, but it's different.
Which is a huge benefit, I think.
We've done a lot of stuff that's really, really cool, but the reality is, the biggest thing we've done, though, is that 99.9% of the developers out there don't actually care, they don't know, and we've abstracted that part away such that it becomes irrelevant. Yep. And that, to me, is a huge success. Is if we can hide the fact that there's a ton of complexity going on underneath them.
Yeah, the marshalling, the proxy stubs, the activation, all that stuff. Security contexts, all that, STAs, ATAs.
STAs, ASTAs, MTAs, all of that stuff. If we can hide that information from the developer, that complexity from the developer, which we've pretty much done, we win. Now, there's some things we haven't hidden that are still out there that developers need to deal with, but we're actively working on fixing that as well. So we're doing things along those lines that will appear in future versions of Windows.
Cool.
So
when you look back in 20 years, you think you've kind of crested the problem where we are now?
Oh, no. There's going to be more problems. Guaranteed. There's always more problems. I already have people asking me to do things that, wait, the system wasn't designed to allow you to do that. Okay. Now I have to figure out how to make that happen. We've already made changes to our type system that are fairly significant in the past two releases. They're small, but they're significant in terms of what you can do with the operating system. I guarantee you we're going to have more things that we will be adding. I guarantee you there's going to be more hard problems to solve. There have to be, because we're never done. You can't be done.
Yeah. The world's evolving, and
you know,
the way we program is evolving, the way that we interpret the world and our devices are evolving. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, the telephony APIs, they haven't changed very much in a long time. But you know what? There's still a whole bunch of 911 call centers that are built on those APIs. Mm. So that's the other half of this, is that it's not actually necessary that you don't always have to advance the API and change the API and move the API forward.
Yeah.
It's not always necessary because sometimes the API doesn't need to be improved. It's actually one of those, if you will, it's a dirty little secret, is that sometimes APIs just get put on life support because it's not necessary. It's not that they're perfect. It's not that they couldn't deal with a brand new reboot, the shiny chrome of paint, or shiny coat of paint on them, polish up the chrome. But the reality is sometimes they do what they need to do and there's not a lot of demand for new functionality. Mm. On the other hand, we thought that was true for the MIDI APIs. This would be a perfect example of this. The MIDI APIs were unchanged for years.
We're talking about audio.
The audio MIDI APIs.
Musical instrument digital.
We jumped a fair way there. But
I did jump a fair way there. But
I know about Larry's audio past. I went MIDI. It doesn't mean middle.
No, I meant MIDI.
But the MIDI spec hasn't really changed in 30 years.
No, it hasn't. But the MIDI APIs, we've produced in 8.1 in Windows 10. There's now a set of MIDI APIs for Windows Runtime apps.
Right.
Why? Because developers said they needed them, they wanted them.
Yeah.
You know, we listen to what our developers ask us for, and we do our best to give it to them if it's all possible.
Do you think the work we've done so far is in any way centric on the consumer space versus the enterprise space? Or do you think it kind of is
irrelevant? That is not a dimension that is significant in this, because we're talking about literally what APIs are available. Mm. And the same APIs, there's a small set of APIs that will be relevant to consumers more than to enterprises. But there's another set of APIs that are relevant to enterprises. So for instance, the Exchange Active Sync provisioning APIs. Mm. Not a lot of consumer space need for that particular set of APIs, but in the enterprise space, the ability to apply ActiveSync provisioning API or policies on a client machine,
things that's
critically important.
Things like it says you must have a PIN number on your phone. And
yeah.
Like that,
yeah, those are all APIs that are enterprise. So APIs are APIs, and they're just things. They exist. They are.
Yeah.
How you use them, you know, some APIs really apply to the consumer space more than the advertising ID API.
Yeah.
You know, the API that basically allows an advertising provider to know in an obfuscated and anonymized way which user that is. Well, enterprises, that's not really that useful for them. But as I said, some of the other APIs, absolutely.
On the flip side, you know, smart cards and all that stuff.
Smart cards.
Are key to enterprises. Yeah,
they're absolutely enterprises. So I don't like to think of APIs as being focused on one set of customers as another set of customers. And at the end of the day, they're just customers.
Yeah.
I personally don't like differentiating, but... So that's because I live in this low-level API surface way.
I suppose the question I was asking, are the contracts cut up in any way to represent...
Right now...
It's like it's the authentication and it has authentication in it.
No.
The fact that it's smart card versus password PIN...
Authentication is part of the... Actually, authentication is actually part of the Universal API platform. Mm. Most of the APIs you can think of are part of the Universal API platform. The reason for splitting up APIs right now is actually that... the reason why we have contracts are because there's functionality that for various reasons could not be brought. Desktop functionality that could not be brought to mobile, mobile functionality that could not be brought to desktop, et cetera, et cetera. That's actually the driving force behind the existing API contracts beyond the Universal API contract. The Universal API contract is the APIs you need to do to build a universal app. And that's what you should think about it, and that's what it is. But there are APIs that go beyond what you need for a universal API that are specific to the desktop, specific to mobile.
To a device type.
And to a device type. And those are APIs that, for whatever reason, could not converge to the common core. Mm. And there are lots of really strong technical reasons for some of those APIs not converging. And so the unconverged APIs are in their own API contracts. The converged APIs are in the universal API contract. Mm. You know, it's not... There's a model where we have many, many, many contracts with very, very fine granularity. We made a very conscious decision not to go with that model for a number of really, really, really strong technical reasons that are beyond the not really relevant. But the reality is that what we have is a single very large contract that has most of the functionality, all the functionality that is needed to build most universal apps. We've built that, and then we have a lot of ancillary contracts around them. Mm. Now, that does not say that over time we might find a need to pull some APIs out of that universal API contract and put them in their own contracts. We may very well be doing that in the future. Who knows? There's literally no way of knowing. We might take some of these other ancillary contracts and move them into the universal API surface.
Yeah.
The system we've designed, and this is the in my mind, the beauty of the system we've designed, is that I have the flexibility, we have the flexibility, the people who define the SKUs of Windows have the flexibility to do whatever they need to do to achieve our goals over the next 20 years. APIs are associated with an API contract. All APIs are associated with an API contract. Platforms are made up by assembling API contracts, and you can pick and choose. And if an API contract has too many APIs, or there are some APIs specifically that you want for your platform that you don't have, you can move them from one to another, create a new API contract, and put that one in your operating system.
Yeah.
Or you can take some things that you don't want to put and take them out of your contract, of the API contract. You can do all of those things, and the system is designed around having the ability to do all of those things.
Cool. Well, what should we?
About it.
Yeah, that's really good. So I'm sure we're at the point where we can talk about a bit of a summary. So people should. I mean, as you said, the majority of people will just write a universal app,
and they're done.
And it's done. It's no thought of additional contracts, additional stuff
like that. You should not. Hopefully, 95% of the developers who are doing this don't care.
Yeah.
And they never will have to care. And frankly, if a significant number of developers do care, then we've done our job wrong. Mm. Because the idea is that this is supposed to be, when I first proposed this idea to my boss's boss, he was like, wait, we have another concept we have to have developers learn about?
Yeah.
Why do developers have to learn about this concept? No, they don't. We've I don't want to use the word hidden.
Abstracted?
We've designed it such that the complexity while the complexity is there, it's invisible.
Yeah.
Hidden visible. We've made it invisible.
Invisible.
That's the right. That's the better way because
yeah.
Hidden implies that there's some kind of malicious intent. But no, we've just made that complexity invisible to the developer. They don't care, unless they're that 0.1% of developers who actually does care. Mm. In which case, we have defined, and there's actually a ton of documentation on how to actually do this and how to take advantage of this adaptive functionality that we've added in Windows 10 to let you make a coherent and reasonable decision.
Yeah. So the simple thing is go grab Visual Studio 2015 or
2013
Update 5 that just came out and get in there and go new universal app.
And then go for it.
And go for your life.
Yep.
And know that your app is going to work on Xbox and on everything else.
And everywhere else. Yes.
Awesome. Yes.
Kind of come over here. Oh. I've been hiding in the corner there.
I know. It's just kissing.
Right on. Sorry. So that's pretty much it for this week. For this, well, we
whatever.
Whatever we end up
how are we going to edit this?
How we edit this down? This always happens when we talk to Larry, though. We get so fascinated. It keeps going.
Yeah. And there's a running joke that I can sit there and derail and take conversations in really weird places that they never were intended to go.
That's why we love you, Larry. That's the best part of talking to you. Yeah. So that it for this week?
Yeah.
All right. Okay. I think so. Well, thanks, Larry, for letting
Thank
us come
guys.
Invade your office and
appreciate it.
You know,
always
check
love
out your cool stuff and the cool work you're doing. This is really, really great.
Yeah.
Yeah, this is wonkier than usual. This stuff is really way wonkier, and it's frustrating me a little bit because there's no visibility whatsoever on this work. We intentionally hid most of this stuff behind the covers.
Yeah.
So it's kind of nice to be able to actually talk about what's going on.
Well, this is the kind of stuff that makes Windows a much better platform, but that isn't really obvious to, you know, the average user, right?
Yeah.
But it's very, very important work.
Yeah.
So.
But this is the thing that puts the app into the store that you go, I want it, Angry Birds on blah and blah, and there you go. That's how it works. That's how it happens.
Very cool.
Yes.
Yeah. So the magic.
More importantly, Minecraft on the HoloLens.
Minecraft on the HoloLens. I was very excited when I saw that demo.
That was very, very impressive. Demo.
It was funny back when it came out that we were buying Minecraft. I was like, man, that's kind of weird. And then that doesn't make a lot of sense. And then when I saw that HoloLens Minecraft demo, I'm like, oh, that's the part I didn't know about.
Well, it made sense to me because my daughters just play Minecraft.
Well, that too. And kids, yeah.
Yeah, my kids played Minecraft for quite a while, but then they sort of stopped.
Oh, my kids haven't stopped yet.
Oh, yeah. My son watches Minecraft videos
Terraria is
every
their current
chance he gets.
Yeah.
It's time suck.
Yes.
So, which is kind of a Minecraft clone.
It is.
There you go. Well, you know, we bought a generation there by buying Minecraft is the way I heard it put.
I think you're right.
Yeah, yeah. All right. Well, thanks again, Larry. And we'll see you guys next week. As always, if you have questions, comments, put them in the show notes down there or email us, defragtools@microsoft.com. And thanks for watching.
See you next week.
Cheers.